Well, hello everyone, and welcome to this month's podcast of Critical Decisions in Emergency Medicine. With you is Danya Koja. I'm an emergency physician who practices in Baltimore, Maryland, and lives pretty much in lots of places around the world.
And I am Wendy Chang, an emergency physician and neurointensivist in Baltimore, Maryland.
And on this podcast, we're going to be talking about the September 2020 issue of Critical Decisions in Emergency Medicine. And if you don't know what Critical Decisions is, what are you waiting for? Critical Decisions is ACEP's official CME publication. And in each month, we talk about two lessons that cover the critical decisions, the bread and butter of emergency medicine, or things that are cutting edge. And we talk about things that are important that you need to think about when you are dealing with this in your emergency department.
There are also a lot of other features, such as the critical image, critical EKG. As our listeners know, my favorite, the LLSA review.
So let's start with the first lesson for this month, mechanical engineering or ventilator management. Thank you to Drs. Andrew Schaub, Christopher Peluso, and Matthew Stahl. You know what, Wendy? We talked about mechanical ventilation 101 recently, and we learned how to choose like lung protective settings, how to consider the causes of peri-intubation decompensation. So take us to this VENTS 102. What else should we consider when we select initial vent settings?
Well, I think it's important to remember that there really is no one-size-fits-all in terms of choosing mechanical ventilation and troubleshooting mechanical ventilation. It's really tailored to your patient and the indication in why the patient is being placed on the vent, whether it's for airway protection, hypercapnia, hypoxia, or maybe excessive respiratory load or respiratory distress. Our goal is to match the patient's physiological conditions. And there's a great example in Table 1 in terms of how to approach specific ventilator settings based on your indication. I think my takeaway is that the mode of the ventilator matters less, but you should be familiar with one or two of them just in case you have to troubleshoot and switch between them. Most commonly, we're talking about volume control and pressure control. Volume control is easier to, by its name, control the tidal volume, the minute ventilation when we're talking about lung protective strategies. But since the pressure is the dependent variable in this case, there is risk of elevated airway pressures in cases where you're dealing with less compliant lungs or excessive coughing.
Got it. So what should we pay special attention to when treating someone who's hypercapnic?
As we know, hypercapnia can result from a number of things, whether it's because the patient is comatose and has a decreased respiratory drive, or if they have poorly compliant or narrow airway, such as in COPD, or maybe some combination. And so whenever we're talking about hypercapnic respiratory failure, we're really worried about, of course, obstructive lung disease, because there's the concern about airflow obstruction, decreased recoil, short expiratory time, all of which result in air trapping, which is dangerous. We want to start with similarly the 6 to 8 milliliters per kilogram of tidal volume, but you want to set the respiratory rate 16 to 20 breaths per minute to kind of approximate kind of what the patient was trying to do before you needed to intubate them. Importantly, allowing time for the exhalation, because obviously we don't want the breath stacking to occur.
Well, that is really tricky though. Like, how can we reduce breath stacking? Something I've heard about is like the IE time. What are your tips about that?
Right. So we sometimes talk about I to E time, which is that ratio between the time that you are delivering a breath or inspiration and the time that you are allowing exhalation. And so normally when we're talking about us walking around, we're in a I to E time of 1 to 2. And so in a lot of these patients, we try to stretch out that exhalation time to give more time for the breath to come out, completely exhale. So we're dealing with 1 to 3, sometimes even up to 1 to 5. In severe cases, we can also allow permissive hypercapnia and really aim to normalize pH rather than PCO2. And really, we're shooting for a pH of greater than 7.2. Because if we are trying to overventilate, trying to simply correct a person's CO2, we could cause things like lung injury. But it's important to remember also permissive hypercapnia isn't really appropriate in patients, let's say, if they're pregnant, if they're dealing with salicylate or tricyclic toxicities, or brain injured patients with elevated ICPs.
Makes sense. So we should not let hypercapnia bother us per se, as long as the pH is above 7.2, as long as they don't have one of these conditions you just mentioned.
Exactly.
All right. So how do we troubleshoot people who are difficult to ventilate? Because sometimes, you know, they just, it doesn't want to work the way it sounds like in a textbook.
That's true. Very true. If the patient's CO2 remains really elevated, you can try to improve CO2 clearance by increasing respiratory rate, which is a lot more effective than increasing tidal volume. Once that you have the respiratory rate optimized, then you can consider making small increments and increasing tidal volume, all of which to really just, again, increasing the person's minute ventilation to, again, clear the CO2. I think it's important to consider non-ventilator strategies too, such as treating pain and agitation, because we've all probably had patients who are intubated or are quote-unquote bucking the vent, causing a lot of ventilator dyssynchrony. And in patients with COPD, et cetera, this can really add to worsening breath stacking. You can even consider heliacs. Of course, we talk about that sometimes in just general management, non-intubated management of obstructive lung disease, but obviously with a ventilator, you can add that too. Paralysis might be necessary, especially in status asthmaticus. And of course, there's always ECMO if you're really dealing with somebody who has unsafe CO2 levels or even air leak syndromes that really need another option to clear their CO2.
Got it. So now that we've talked about how to deal with the CO2 problems, let's talk about the O2 problems. Any tips and tricks on how to deal with hypoxic respiratory failure?
Sure. I think in some ways, dealing with refractory hypoxemia is easier than dealing with terrible hypercarbia, like in the COPD patient and asthmatic patient. Really, when you're dealing with hypoxemic respiratory failure, you can use volume control or pressure control, because really your goal is just to improve oxygenation by improving alveoli opening, improving alveoli recruitment, etc. It's key that you don't just use FiO2 and turning and cranking the O2 level up, because that can cause oxygen toxicity, free radicals, and actually worsen shunting. If you're really dealing with somebody who is persistently hypoxemic, then you're talking about up titration of their PEEP or FiO2 really by the ARDS-NET protocol, which is in table 2. And there's also a really great diagram in figure 1 that provides a stepwise approach to how to take care of these patients.
All right. So that sounds like a great starting point. But again, patients don't always want to listen to what we're trying to do, and they don't follow the textbook. And despite all of this, they still have refractory hypoxemia. How do we troubleshoot that?
I think some of us have probably heard of the mnemonic DOPES, D-O-P-E-S, which is a good first step in making sure that you're not dealing with displacement of the tube, obstruction of the tube, a pneumothorax, equipment failure, or stacked breaths. But let's say you've ruled all that out and your patient is still hypoxic. You want to, again, sedate them to optimize the ventilator's ability to do its work. Paralysis is also often used. But I think what we're learning a lot in the ED, especially with the recent pandemic that we won't name, proning is really effective, and it actually improves mortality in patients with ARDS. So we encourage using proning early on if you're anticipating the patient's, you know, respiratory status to get worse. Other strategies include just different ventilator modes, pulmonary vasodilators, and of course, there's always ECMO again.
I think you just like to say ECMO, Wendy. That's personally yes. My thought. But so thank you for taking us through this, and thank you again for the authors for writing this article. This was a great reminder of the fact that, you know, basic Vents 101 is, it's not about the mode. Learn exactly what you're trying to do and just do it. Lung protective strategies are great. Today, we talked about how it's important to match the physiology of the patient as much as possible and how to deal with hypercapnia. For that, we can increase the respiratory rate and increase the exhalation time by increasing the ITE ratio from 1:2 to closer to 1:3 to 4:5, something like that. And make sure you address the pain and agitation, because maybe that is the problem, all that bucking of the tube per se. with hypoxemia, it's important for us to not just increase the FiO2, but to increase the mean airway pressure to recruit the alveoli and to think of the DOPES mnemonic for refractory hypoxemia, which is displacement, obstruction, pneumothorax, equipment failure, and stacked breaths, and to not forget about proning. And then finally, the magic word, ECMO.
That's right.
While staying within the same theme of airway and vents and things like that is the LSA review, which talks about pediatric airway and rapid sequence intubation. And the article specifically talks about trauma, but the pearls in that LSA review can be applied to all peds airways. So take us away, Wendy. Keep talking about airways and vents, but this one is like smaller sized.
Yes, definitely smaller sized. So as you can imagine, the pediatric airway anatomy is different. We've always been taught that the larynx is more anterior, the tongue is larger, and the cricoid cartilage is the narrowest part of the airway in those who are less than 10 years old. If you're using oropharyngeal airways, you want to insert that directly and not to rotate it 180 degrees because you don't want to cause soft tissue trauma. There's some math to be done whenever you're dealing with pediatric patients. And so specifically for the airway, you often want to figure out the appropriate size of the tube based on the patient's age. And that formula is age divided by 4 plus 3.5. Look at your handy DNA pediatric, you know, cards for all these things. And the other formula that's really helpful is, you know, what depth are you really aiming for? And that's the ET tube size times 3. And this is important because
I can remember that formula.
Much easier. This is important because, you know, 30% of pediatric intubations end up being right main stemmed. And, you know, partly because of probably our adrenaline and also because of their anatomy. And really subtle head movements can really dislodge the tube.
And because of our math skills.
Yes, exactly.
Who are we kidding? Well, thank you, Andy, for taking us through this. Definitely pediatric airways, whether trauma or otherwise, are super scary because they're really small. And these are fantastic reminders.
For our critical procedure this month, it's a trigger point injection, which I've learned a lot because I've actually never done one, even though we talk about people having trigger points and maybe telling our patients why that's the reason they're presenting with their back pain. And the procedure is quite simple. And there's, of course, as usual, a great diagram and the steps to go through. You're really trying to inject a myofascial trigger point using 1 to 2 cc's of local anesthetic and then massage it. Kind of like dry needling, but obviously you have the injection of the anesthetic.
With drugs.
With drugs. So not to dry needling.
So it's not dry needling. It's wet needling.
Exactly. I didn't want to say that, but that's right.
I mean,
right. Exactly. Another point that I thought was helpful is that you shouldn't use steroids because these are not actually proven inflammatory processes. So you're really just providing, you know, local anesthetic for pain control.
That's a great reminder. So for our critical image this month, it's a pretty interesting case of a patient with multiple falls, vertigo, and abnormal gait, and the patient drinks alcohol daily. However, with the vertigo and the abnormal gait, they got an MRI brain to rule out a cerebellar stroke, and they end up having Wernicke's encephalopathy. And one, the MRI is pretty interesting. Obviously, we shouldn't be ordering MRIs on purpose to diagnose Wernicke's. But there's a lot of very interesting stuff in the write-up, which is one, a reminder that the triad, which is gait ataxia, oculomotor dysfunction, and mental status change, is only present in 10% of cases. So if you're looking for that, you're out of luck. And then the second reminder that I thought was super awesome was that it's not just alcohol that precipitates Wernicke's encephalopathy, but all starvation malabsorption, which also includes hyperemesis gravidarum, advanced AIDS, and malignancy. And then, of course, the magical, well, the question and the answer are thiamine. So, ta-da! And apparently an MRI of the brain. But definitely take a look. It's super interesting, and it's a great reminder of something that is easily fixed.
For our critical cases in orthopedics and trauma this month, it's a case of an ACL tear and bucket handle fracture. And I thought it was an interesting case because sometimes our patients come in and tell us that their knee is locked. There's actually a locked knee syndrome, which is when you have a meniscal injury where the meniscus actually flips into the intercondylar notch, preventing the normal flexion and extension of the knee joint, and therefore it is locked. There is a bucket handle lesion, hence the name, and there's a great figure and image of that.
So, I mean, this sounds really dramatic for you to like lock your knee and not be able to move it. Does this happen from like major trauma?
Unfortunately not, which is, I think, scarier. It's actually usually from non-contact low-grade trauma where, let's say, your foot is planted and then you have a sudden change in direction or deceleration. And so it can happen with recreational sports or, you know, dancing wrong in your own house.
So it's really great, Wendy. We talk about this and now I don't ski. I don't do any contact sports. And now apparently I can't do non-contact sports either, or apparently even dance. So after you read these things, you just want to sit, but then you can't sit all day because that's not good for you either. You'll get some disease.
I think
that,
the key is you got to dance while doing the twist with your feet. And so that way your foot is not planted.
Do not plant your foot.
Patients often complain of a popping sensation when this happens. And so in these cases, if you're suspicious of an injury like this, you do want to get an urgent MRI, as these will require a meniscal repair or even a meniscectomy.
And moving on to a completely different topic, our critical EKG this month is about Wellen syndrome. And there are great examples of the different types of T-wave inversions that are present in Wellens, which, as you all know, is a critical stenosis of the proximal LAD. So it's kind of a big deal for us to find it. So definitely take a look and remind yourself of the types of the T-wave inversions in that syndrome.
And for our second lesson in this issue, code BRUI, brief resolved unexplained events. Thank you to Drs. Jennifer Bellis and Audrey Paul for writing this. So I thought I finally got ALTIs down, you know, apparent life-threatening events, but now I have to remember what BRUI stands for. Why has the name changed?
So we basically decided that it's better to keep confusing people with different acronyms. So that's, I think, the real reason. But actually, BRUIs are there because they're brief, resolved, unexplained events. And they're supposed to be a lot clearer than ALTIs, which their definition is an episode that is frightening to the observer and is characterized by some combination of apnea, central or obstructive, color change, cyanotic or pale or plethoric or erythematous, and marked change in muscle tone, which is usually limpness, and choking or gagging. Which to me sounds really vague because, like, if you frighten easily, then everything to you is an ALTI. So that's not really a diagnostic criteria. That's number one. Number two, it does not actually include an age group. And it's not clear if the people who had the ALTI at home are still ALTIing in your presence or not. So it was just, to be honest, too vague. And that is why the concept of BRUI came out, which is the brief resolved unexplained events. And there's a great figure in the article that kind of clarifies that. So here are things that are super clear about the BRUI. They must be less than a year old. It must be less than a minute long, whatever the it is. And it must be unexplained by an unidentifiable medical condition. The patient must return to baseline with a normal exam and normal vitals. And the event must include one or more of the following: cyanosis or pallor, absent decrease or irregular breathing, a marked change in tone, so hyper or hypotonia, and an altered level of consciousness. One or more of these must be present.
Wow, okay. That is a lot more specific. What are some pros and pitfalls in identifying BRUIs, or I like to call them BRUIs, I'm sure incorrectly?
So there are things that are not BRUI, all right? If there were current events, it's not one. If there's just isolated perioral cyanosis and no other change in color, that's not a BRUI. If it's a red baby, that's not a BRUI. Another pearl is that the irregular breathing does not include the periodic breathing that's present in newborns. It does not include the breath-holding spells that are in older infants. It's true regular breathing. Another thing that is commonly confused with the brew and it's not are infantile spasms. And finally, choking or gagging that are associated with spitting up are not brew. So those are some clarifications and tips for things that are not brew.
Okay, that is really helpful. So why is this important then?
So it's important for us to figure out what a brew is because they can be scary in the sense that they're caused by something serious. The most important differential diagnoses to think of in someone with brew are infection, congenital abnormality, and non-accidental trauma. And the key is to identify the infants that are low risk and therefore don't need a workup, and identify the ones that are not low risk and give them the workup that they need. There is a fantastic table in the article that explains what are the low-risk criteria and the not-so-risk criteria. The biggest take-home point from this whole article and this whole discussion is that a thorough history and physical exam are the most important things that you can do to care for a baby with brew.
Okay, so what are these risk factors that really help us figure out what to do for these babies?
So the low-risk brew are babies that are older than 60 days old, if they're born 32 weeks or older, or if their corrected age is 45 weeks or older, if they never needed CPR by a trained medical professional, if the event was less than a minute, and if it was a first event. That's a low-risk brew. Keep in mind that CPR provided by someone who is not a trained medical professional does not actually count. So if it's not done by an EMT or a registered nurse, it does not count as something that makes you not low risk. If you only receive CPR by a parent or an untrained caregiver, it is still a low risk infant.
If the patient is low risk, what do we do for them? Can we just discharge them?
Well, I mean, the ultimate goal is yes. However, there are some things that you can consider doing for these patients. You can consider doing pertussis testing, a 12-lead EKG, and an observation period, which is like 1 to 4 hours with a pulse ox. Now, keep in mind that you should consider these things and you don't need or have to do them for everyone because there is not really clear evidence. With pertussis, the reason that's there in the consensus is because apnea can happen before the baby has a cough or shortness of breath. It's a pretty serious disease that's relatively easy to find. And in order for you to decide whether or not you need to test for pertussis, consider potential exposure, community prevalence, vaccination status. EKG is on this list because it's cheap and easy. And observation, because again, it's relatively easy. However, keep in mind that you may pick up pulse ox dips that are not a thing, that are not a real problem with that. And you are being overly cautious and you may admit people who don't actually need anything or that have nothing wrong with them. So this is low level evidence. Remember that chair decision making and good return precautions are necessary. And what's most important is outpatient follow-up within 24 hours. You don't have to do labs. You don't have to do imaging. And please do not give them empiric anti-epileptics or antacid treatments.
Gotcha. Now, what about high-risk features?
So high-risk features are the opposite of the low-risk features, right? So if the age is less than 60 days, or if they're preemie babies, so they're born at less than 32, or if their corrected age is less than 45 weeks, if they have any feeding or growth problems, remember that feeding problems in a baby are signs of a possible cardiac condition. If you have any social concerns that you don't think they're going to be able to come back for that 24-hour follow-up, if they have a family history of sudden cardiac death or an unexplained death of a young child, if they have a history of a respiratory problem, if they've had multiple events or prolonged events, or if there's just something that's concerning you about non-accidental trauma.
So what do we do for these kids?
Well, again, there are no clear recommendations. We should be guided by the factor that indicated to us that they're not low risk. So for example, if we have suspicion for non-accidental trauma, we should look for trauma. If we are suspecting that they're not growing and not feeding well, then maybe heart disease is something a little more acute than infection. Most of these babies who meet this high-risk criteria are going to be admitted. So it's going to be somebody else's problem.
Gotcha.
But at least they are not going home.
Well, thank you, Danya. This was really helpful in terms of giving us a better idea on what a brew is, which I learned it's really defined as those who are less than 1 year old, less than 1 minute in duration, they must return to normal. And It can be symptoms such as pallor, irregular breathing, or change in tone without a identifiable medical condition. And it really comes down to risk stratifying these babies to determine what to do for them. The low risk features, as you mentioned in this really incredible table, suggest that these kids will likely not have a recurrent event and can be discharged. You can consider some of the testing you mentioned, whether pertussis testing, EKG, or observation period. But really, the high-risk features are those who need to be admitted for further management.
Exactly. Also, the most important thing is that we should stop calling them ulties.
Can I call them bruies?
I think you can. You can call them bruies, I'll call them brews, but at the end of the day, we will not call them ulties.
I'm just really stuck in that two syllable.
Well, I think to make up for this word that we can't agree on how to pronounce, the drug box is a relatively straightforward drug that we use all the time.
It's in my back pocket, along with propofol. Not to be confused with propofol, because they look quite alike. So
that would not go too well.
So the drug box this month is on clavitipine. And as Tanya mentioned, it has definitely increased in utilization over the past few years because it's so easy. It's an IV titratable calcium channel blocker, specifically a dihydropyridine. It has a really short half-life, 1 minute or so. And so the effect is gone within 5 to 15 minutes, allowing you to really control a person's blood pressure well in such as neurological conditions, but also other conditions.
Oh my God, you found it. You found some neuro thing to talk about today.
There were several, I had to still squeeze it in. It lowers blood pressure without affecting myocardial contractility or cardiac conduction. And typically you'll start at 1 to 2 milligrams per hour. You can double it every 90 seconds with a max dose of 16 milligrams per hour. The key is that you can't use this with patients who have soy or egg allergies or patients with severe aortic stenosis. You should also watch out for reflex tachycardia that can occur.
And for our talks box this month, we're talking for a change about something that I'm not at risk of eating. We're talking about venomous fish stings, which is scary because I've swam near stingrays before. Thankfully, they were tiny and they kind of liked me because they didn't try to attack me, so yay me. Now, with venomous fish stings, the problem is that the spines in the tails of stingrays, for example, or the fins of scorpionfish can cause local tissue destruction. And that local tissue destruction causes intense pain, lots of edema, and tissue necrosis. The solution for that is to immerse the extremity in warm water, so 40 to 45 degrees Celsius. And if there are large wounds or deep wounds, then you need to x-ray them to look for the spine sheath and make sure they don't have any foreign bodies so you can take them out. Another important thing is that you can end up with an infection from whatever is in the water because now you have wounds that were in the water. So Vibrio would be your saltwater thing and Aeromonas in freshwater. Recommendations are not clear if we should prophylax all of these wounds. Personally, if it's a really big wound and it looks scary, then I will give you prophylaxis according to zero recommendations, but more like consensus. I would give Cipro for that, in addition to something to cover for skin flora like cefalexin or doxycycline.
Just so you know, I Googled what a scorpionfish looks like, and the common questions are, how poisonous is a scorpionfish, and is scorpionfish good to eat? Hopefully not at the same time, but I also learned today that scorpionfish is 100% safe to eat if you trust the internet.
Oh, okay. All right, great. So I'm adding this on the list of things that I can eat, but I should not get stung by. Got it. Well, dear listeners, I hope you had as much fun listening to us as we've had recording this.
We hope that you find the publication as well as our podcast always informative, often enlightening, and never boring.
We would love for you to reach out with us and connect with us on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @DaniaKojo.
Mine is @EM_NCC.
And until next month,
bye-bye.